Tonight I have the great pleasure of introducing first-year poetry fellow April Freely. April graduated from Brown University and the University of Iowa, where she received an MFA in nonfiction. Her work has appeared in Seneca Review, Ninth Letter, New Madrid Review, and Gulf Coast. A Cleveland native, she has received a 2014 Individual Excellence Award from the Ohio Arts Council. Please join me in welcoming April.
Wow. Oh, I'm so happy to be here with all the folks from FOC. I guess I should begin by thanking all the people. So that includes Bruno, Cecily, Krista, James, Matt, Alex and Jen, and Tom Slay. That's it. And everybody else. Bruno, we love you. Yeah. Awesome. Okay, so this is going to be a little bit different. My phone wants to listen to me. This is going to be a little bit different today. I'm going to read a poem that is not my poem to start, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I'm interested in terms of sort of a evolving statement of poetics, and then we're going to talk about this poem that I'm going to read, and then you can ask questions, and then it's over. Yay! All right. So this is a poem called, can you hear me? Turn, baby. No. Ah, there?
Yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Here's a poem called From D by Brenda Coltis. Your singing is very beautiful. It's what attracted me, like a bird to a bath, a flamingo on one leg. I raised my head and opened my mouth. Doing readings has spoiled me. People come to be seduced. They want to be lulled. They want to enter, and so do I. It's why movie screens are bigger than life. We all want to be swallowed. All right. Yay, readings. All right, so I have projected here a poem called Sutro, and I'm going to talk about it, and then I'm going to read it. Let's see, you will notice it is one long poem. Right now I'm writing really long poems, and that may make it a little tricky for you to experience in the reading here. And so I'm going to try to give you some points of access before we begin. You will notice that it looks weird. There's lots of words on the page, and it's a little bit the text is sort of scattered along the field of white space here. You will notice that there are gaps here. You will notice that there's boxes that your left side and your right side is justified. It's a little bit like swaddling you. And it's about my mother. My mother had a heart transplant in 2009, and then she had some cancers, and then she had some organ rejection, and she is mostly alive, and she's repeatedly alive. And so for this poem, what we're going to do is look at the same images over and over and over and see how they change and see, you know, we're thinking about the mother, we're thinking about mother with a capital M and how these things refract and change over time. And so that's that. I think it's interesting for me as a writer because I'm usually situated within this experimental poetics landscape. And that's very useful. I'm not sure how aware everybody is of, you know, the different camps and such. But there's also one element that's going to be happening here that's usually missing. People will say, like, language poetry. People will say, like, objectivist and symbolist and all this jazz. But what I want to talk about today is a marginal experience and how being a marginal person in several ways sort of shapes the complexity of the text, like why it's going to be pushing against you a little bit as a reader. Does this make sense? Ah, it's like school. I love it. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. So we have this big mama here, who is my mother, who I would describe as like ornery, a little, not a mother who is, we're not doing this big earth mother character. We're doing a mother with a little bit of fire to her. And we learned a lot about difficulty and how to live in landscapes of difficulty from these kinds of mothers. So that's the gist of that. Let's see if there's anything else I want to talk about before we begin. Do, 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 do. I think that is all. Oh, I will read this paragraph for you. Are you ready? There is a kind of power in deformation of the poetic landscape that is not just experimental. There is a kind of power in breaking the field, turning away, not being so nice, that is particularly of use for folks who are other or marginal, whether it be through the gender, race, sexual orientation, etc. So I want you to see the warmth in what may look like an alienating text, but there is a mother in there who really does want to feed you. And so when we get to the question and answer, anything you want to ask me, anything that's confusing or hard, I will love to talk about. Are you ready? All right. Sutro. An imaginary number in the clavicle of day. It's hard to see without strain. Oh, we can start looking at the, it's for you. An imaginary number in the clavicle of day is hard to see without strain. My mother and I are suspended 212 feet above ground on a bridge or parallel to us, mere feet away. There is a second bridge, swaying. Traffic flows in the opposite direction. The multiplex below, the metro parks below. The valley below is real. There is nothing comforting about it. Time is a fold in my body, along the edge of blue shale in my terraced Ohio. Smearing gradients I see in the distance are a mechanism of the coast. This rare Midwestern fog now scattering and opposing the light. The canopy like waves at low tide. Next, what looks like Sutro Tower, changing an angle of incidence on my left. But on the right, there is another Sutro. Despite my mother, my passenger, the succulents, and the slope, this is San Francisco, and I am alone with feral rosemary bushes in the Devil Strip, wafting up dense and slow. I can't even hear her voice. Motorists on I-480 are afraid the bridge will buckle, which changes the pressure in a muscle I can't name, in the blind spot all zero out. I have clamped my peripheral vision down for safety, my body as any lighted screen. To get over this bridge, forget infrastructure, erosions, all in the near combustion. My hand reaches across the plane of her body, in maternal reflex, between my mother and the front of the plastic cab, diastolic against systolic. That slash, the full gesture, the quality of waking is, I drive down the brake. Between any two elements, I am the third, pressing the body down in repetitive motion, as all mothers now lean across my hand. From this angle, I am at her face, blinking for 93 minutes. My eyes burning into her left side. I know this side well. As if restrained, she grabs her commuter cup. I try to get her to come at me head on, stills a microsecond apart. My mother is a kind rain. When she turns her head now, notice several radial mistakes as if she's a stranger. Neither does the day know goniometer, the confusion of my own face in the absences of commuters. The flat dot is only lightly colored in. I recall celebrants, chariots pulling along a bridge or bridges. Day is the culmination, the whip bringing in near full detail innumerable coronas. During this press of machinery across a second expanse, I forget I break into or toward the site of Bernal Heights, the shock of the lower canopy or the higher. I do not believe I was so close to the world ending. When you are moving alongside the mother at the hip, she attends to her business, bends over you, and you drop. Mental maps fail to account for high tides, the ragged edge, and the clean dispersal of my Ohio into hundreds of Californias. To make discrete images cohere, I tip into the blind spot. I'm meant to be found in the moment before it got strange, before her heart complications, before the transplant, bypass. Even as a child, I want the moment before the ego split. Back to the simple form, my tower against the landscape. Forget the bridge, forsake all these double sutras. I want back one passenger instead of symbiotic infinities of mothers. I want to take this mother for granted, like a power in the distance, so I can be a kind of noise from underground wires. Rats get lost in a white box. All that noise. Let the sea fall away. Let the tide amber drift of the valley in a new town. I lose responsibility for the memory you would say is all wrong. I love the ugly itch of a mark on land. A kind of pain is turning away. Not inviting, but instructive. We tilt slightly forward across this bridge on tiptoe as we approach her. A series is real. The face does distort this contrapuntal body. Muscles underneath the surface pulling in opposite directions, darker and lighter areas, like a social studies diagram, illustrating the schema of mesa, cavern, and town. It is not a real place, you know, a collection of features, but no real occurrence, like my face closed down when I am not looking at you. I make my face a blind. I hide all my guns. Get back to your mother as a child grabs hold the soft of mother's upper arm, near and not in. Maps should not be conflated. Object permanence is the first mother hidden in her own hands. Peek at the mother now lost in a field of, this is how the landmark works. Hands you know pulled back to reveal the familiar face you have forgotten amid it. Day is tatted with maths. Not counting, little homunculus, but bearing the measure. Inside this body is another live body, the first blocks out. One who makes me blink, makes my temperature rise and fall. My autonomic mother who finds me each morning, the rousing one who looks after me at night. I wake up in the violence of the first breath. This is how day becomes a problem into which I press my face. The rousing mother in her white dress is the pale stripe of the receding relative solving the series. I leave her to her work. 0, 1, 1, 3, 5, 11, or the smallest non-isolated or twin prime, that needle now just millimeters from the black bar. Sutro doesn't let you out of sight. After all, you are what's moving. You can't keep the landmark. Let go. We run through an entire handful of sutros, like the body of the first mother shaking off when she turns her head. In early photographs, you don't know quite what you are becoming. Then wind, then the finest prints of white-capped seas, then two rock pigeons maintaining the hand with complex joint between them. Shoulder to shoulder, we make believe Sutro is the fortified location. Shocked is our human goal, that death, that familiar face. I vacillate between believing I can find my way and not believing. Object permanence is the trick, not this morning's time warp, not this plural continua. Let my mental map become impossibly small. Here are the shakes. Opposite sides of the color wheel happen naturally. At first light, those clouds like nicotineless smoke. I go to mash on my mother in the edema of light coming and going. Loss happens. The clock is a tease. Some answers are both one and negative one. I watch my mother's face. See if the big eye is after the little eye. If her right temple will twitch. If the sun rising as red washes on the dark plain. If her lips moving. If the whites of her eyes as the sun comes up, white hot in a white sky. Day is an entering suburb, a little confusing directionally, meaningless curved roads that follow no real topography, but bright, nicely manicured gardens nonetheless. My mother got out of the car. I reached over the closet. Her face, superficies. One is always alone. This is the real work, building the fog of relationship or the keen or the weft. Wheels turn beneath us as day is the final push, bearing down. Mother, I feel suddenly certain every scattered face is cause for grief. Every mountain without appreciation, a name. I love Citro above other towers as it reveals all the ways we will take any mother. This is not a sight error. Dashes along an analog dial, like the face of someone you love in pain. California, the red line underneath. Find the groove pain has removed her to. In a long, frazzled conversation, I come upon the mother's hidden tripwire. Day is like waking into our real location where we have already grown tired. A knot in the dark distractibility increase of relationship, we make a wail. Dear diplopia, dear visual field defect, even this block in the ambient pathway, neurological insult, fog, an analogy is not an emotion. A landmark is not something we fool. Big Mama is in charge of bringing out one to play and putting her away. She's sleeping. Dolls are a kind of practice, making them speak, washing their plastic bodies. By now, I recognize the numbness that comes upon me in sleep as I sit next to the mother, not speaking, also by touch. I keep Sutro to myself like a small midnight hour I learned from the other dolls. Seven Sisters show there are seven ways to hold the breath. My mother wakes from her morphine sleep, asking, what next? This is the warp of day, her shock, her still room, just another white box on earth, where she repeats the horror of waking several times. When the full light hits, day is a long labor across a landscape that is not still even once, neither true, level, plumb, or sound. The day we are reaching for throws us down the next sloping drive. I would like you to know now the proper word for this is not shock. A pilgrimage tamps you down, makes you lie flat. You'd follow something I'd call fear, trying to scan the darkness for color. Beneath the red black, find the bluer black. Beneath seafoam green and its black that is breaking up. Black like a swift exhalation, black that exceeds the bound. Even Big Mama is quiet, waiting to see if it is breathing. I wake like light on a clutch of mirrors. Shock gives us some idea of the relative size of such a large anima. A landmark is the well-behaved reflection in full sight of my ornery one. No, a landmark is the opposite of the directions you give yourself. You lose her. You are going to lose her. She will fade away in a cold fog. We have already seen the blunt hand, the press of another character larger than these. After a day at the hospital, I'd fall into bed as if rocked, then flattened by the laying on of hundreds of hands, at last, thankfully, pushed back by the weight of a very thick smoke. Regarding object permanence, she said, I was afraid the sun would never rise. I scolded myself, told myself, this is a cliche. This is iambic. This fear is a known entity, formal, like bowing my head, evening first, then morning, the first day I tore down. All right. Questions? Aww. Good. Questions? Be brave. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so the gaps between the phrases here, lots of folks will call them sestiras, And it's something that people use in place of punctuation. I use them here because if I'm talking about, you know, this landscape that I want people to inhabit, this landscape of difficulty, one way we inhabit it is by getting it into our bodies, and you have to get into your bodies if there's no punctuation for you. The only place it can reside is in your, like, diaphragm. You have to read it. So that's that part. And, you know, why? I think I'm interested in, so I talked about marginal, right? And I'm thinking about, like, okay, so you have this marginal character, say Monet's Olympia, you've got this dark character in the background, right? What is life like if you change the point of view? Like, what is the field of vision like? And so what I'm trying to do here, I think, is, like, create a new field of vision. And so that's why it's like words all over, right? It's like the words, what are they doing up there, right? So I think, yeah, I think that those are the things that are important to me, the sort of troubling of what we think of as sight and troubling what we think of as, like, a poetic moment. It should be, I want, like, a landscape, I want an experience, and this is one way that I get towards that. Yeah. Another. That's it? Yeah. That's a great question. Okay. So for me, these kinds of poems happen when I get a bit of an image. Like, I was in the car, we were driving along the highway, we were looking at a power tower, I was driving, it was Ohio, and I saw it, and it looked like Sutro, which is impossible. It looked like Sutro, so I had this bit of the image, and then I know some things about it. I know some things about why it resonates for me, so I'll know, like, oh, this is about a time-space warp, this is about, this has to do with being mistaken, distortion, mothers, the death, the aging, right? So I know these things, and I shake. So I'll get my image, and I'll mark the things that I know to begin, and then I just throw words until I feel like I've arrived at what the image wanted to tell me, and then I stop. And then I have all these words, and then I take almost all the words away. And then I'm like, okay, where's the beginning? Then I find the beginning, and I'm like, okay, what's the next line? And I find the next line, and that's like, yeah. So for me, I know it's done when I have, say, 5 things that I know. In this case, there might be 10. 10 things that I know the poem wants to tell me. And then when I feel like I've written enough words that I've reached that moment, then I stop. That sounds crazy. Yeah. I think that's magical. I think that this is, for me, I had my mama in the car. I was taking her to a seminary an hour and a half away. And when I got this sort of visual hiccup here, you know, for me, at least as the poem bears out, there's something about having this figure who's, like, always right here. And there's something about the sort of permanence or impermanence of the blinking of her. That had to do with, like, it's when you, it's cool, right? You go to a place that you love, you have this landmark, you walk around the town, but it's always a shock to you when you see it. Like, whenever I see Pilgrim Monument, I'm like, what the heck? How did it get right there? I know it's there, but I'm, like, always surprised. And I think that what we think about with landmarks is that they're not a surprise. And obviously, that's less true to our real experience of being in place than we think it is. Yeah. Yeah, for me, I would say I don't write about people, I write about buildings. So it helps. So I'm writing about Sitar Tower, not my mama, nuh-uh. And so when we get to the part where I know, oh, it's about my mama. I did not know when I started the poem that it was about my mama. I'm like, oh, snap. I know that readers are gonna wanna know, like, oh, how are you feeling? And I'm like, I'm not interested, right? I'm interested in something emotive, but not like a description of feeling. I want an inaction of feeling. And so that other, having this other focus helps me like steer away from, I don't know. It's like, and then I got to the end of the poem and I was like, I can't even be writing this poem. it's the easy thing. But after you've worked it so long, the trouble is still there, I think. I hope. Yay. Yeah. Okay. So you're, San Francisco. It's it's in San Francisco. This is the Sutro man. He's the person who also did the Sutro pools. It's this really ugly thing. I couldn't show a picture of it. Who loves ugly things? Nobody. Yeah. Well, what's the second part? Are these sutros? What did she say? Are they sutros? What do y'all think? Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think. Yeah. I think, yeah. I think each new page, each turning is another version. Yeah, a big giant text document, then 20,000 words, and then 2,000 words. Yeah. I'm done. I've been talking a long time. Thank you so much.
First year fiction fellow, Young Rader, holds an MFA from Washington University in St. Louis, where he was a third year fellow. His work can be found in Little Star, New England Review, and elsewhere. Please join me in welcoming Young Rader.
Okay, I just want to thank the Fine Arts Work Center. Happy Valentine's Day. Is that good? Can you hear me? Higher? Okay, is that better? Okay, is that good? Okay, wait. So I want to thank the Fine Arts Work Center. I want to thank Bridget, Vicky, Bruno, Matt, James. And also I have to say it's a great honor to read with April. I thought that was wonderful. So I'll be reading a short story, and it's made up of four different parts. The books, one. When I was a child, I read a slim book, a compendium of horrifying and true coincidences which provoked in me many anxieties. One of the stories, the story I will tell to you now, began charmingly with, he wrote out to his colleague's sprawling estate. The large clusters of blooming rhododendron seized all his senses. Later, the man wakes to the sound of a shovel hard at work. He peers out of his window and sees someone beside a dark hole in the yard. It is not his colleague. The man, curious, walks outside with his nightcap on and asks, "Are you the gardener?" The stranger does not stop working. The hole grows larger, deeper. The man says, "It's an unusual hour to be working." The stranger looks up, revealing a wide face with a small nose, a mouth crammed with pointed teeth. His eyes are deep set and black. The man returns to his bedroom, scared, and when he looks out the window, he notices that the stranger has disappeared. In the morning, he asks his colleague why the gardener was working so late, but his colleague asks, "What gardener?" Nearly a decade passes, and the man is late to a crucial presentation. He pushes mightily against the revolving door and hurries to the elevators, where, to his dismay, he discovers a congregation of people. Finally, a chime. The elevator's metal doors part smoothly open. The man shoves his way inside. The operator turns around and asks, "Which floor?" And to the man's horror, he recognizes the operator as the stranger from his colleague's estate years and years ago. 14, the man says. "No more room," a man deep in the corner who has seen much better days but has no recollection of them at all, says to a woman standing just outside the elevator doors. "Oh, great," she says, and the doors begin to close. But the man reaches out. The doors hobble open. "Come on," someone says. "We don't have time for this," someone else says. The man steps off the elevator and lets the woman on. "Thank you," she says gratefully. The doors close, but not before the man catches the operator's eyes, the operator's pointed teeth. The man waits for the next elevator, but the next elevator never arrives. There is a loud noise, like an explosion. The lights dim. There is smoke. Everyone around the man is hysterical. Later, the man reads about the accident in the newspaper. There is no mention of an elevator operator among the deceased. And when he asks, the young woman behind the desk says, "We don't employ elevator operators here." 2. The book is not very good, but I am a diligent reader and maybe even a little desperate. My eyes move over the next sentence. Now in the summer of Philip's 14th year, the still surface of youth receded and gave way to the more unfamiliar patterns and directions and growths of adulthood that had suddenly risen up to meet him. I close the book. The book's title is The Dancing Thumbs. The word provocative appears on the back cover in red twice. There is a blurb from a well-known author who has claimed to be haunted and transformed by the book's premise, which serves as a commentary upon the normal with curiously complex characters. "It is horrifying and slippery, ... wow," the well-known author's blurb concludes. Let me tell you more about the book. The book is about a boy, Philip, who becomes obsessed with a much older man whose appearance and sex constantly changes from chapter to chapter and confuses poor Philip, drives him to holy misery. For some reason, it is crucial to know that Philip grows 2 inches taller in one summer and styles his bread-colored hair with pomade. Basically, he becomes a stud. Then he goes crazy, and a crazy stud with a pompadour is truly light and sad on my heart. He cries a lot, and there is a chill in all his words. It is not very long. That is one reason why I bought The Dancing Thumbs in the English bookstore around the corner. There is no one here I can talk to without feeling that all my organs are contracting, so I patronize the English bookstore. The Dancing Thumbs is a used book and has a good used book smell to it. It has a vibrant yellow cover with one line drawn head enveloping a smaller line drawn head. The title also appeals to me because it is one of the more ridiculous titles I've come across. And if I am being honest, another reason why I purchased The Dancing Thumbs is because it was cheaper than the other book I considered buying instead. The other book was longer and heavier, and its pages were slightly crepitated. I cheated and looked at the last sentence of The Dancing Thumbs before I read the first sentence. The last sentence is, "It is nothing. I went on a long walk in the tear garden and bit my nails, and a handsome man showed me his penis. He stood in dappled shade and held his penis in his hand, offered it to me with a shake. But I didn't know what had happened until after I'd passed by him and thought, there was a penis in that man's hand. I walked out of the tear garden with clumsy feet and ate a hamburger and ordered a beer. My sudden hunger seemed bottomless. A woman in a nearby booth reached out across her table and caught in her palm the peas that tumbled out of a much older man's mouth. That's when I cheated and opened The Dancing Thumbs. I read out loud, "It is nothing." I'm sure none of my friends back home would read The Dancing Thumbs. They are mathematicians. I don't even know how we became friends, but we are, and it has been good. I like to watch them raise their hands and mangle the air as they explain to me how to crease hypothetical spaces. I picture a Chinese folding screen, panels decorated with silk stars and moons, opening up and closing above the mathematicians' waving hands. When I ask them what exists in these hypothetical spaces, the mathematicians tell me to stop trying to imagine something and nothing. I tell them that if you hold a book long enough, it begins to carry your scent and that that is something. They are always hunched over, drawing countless shapes on paper, drawing lines and saying that there are an infinite number of points within the lines that they've drawn. Faces, vertices are words they use. They eat spoonfuls of Nutella instead of crying, never open their windows or water their plants, wear extremely colorful socks, and one of them even claims to have once rested his forehead against a dry cow's belly, only to have the unborn calf on the other side kick and knock him unconscious. They tell me, half jokingly, that I am their dumbest friend. It is true, none of us has ever been in love. We wait. We are waiting. Here is something. Start with an exceedingly high number, then begin to count backwards by 7 in your head. 3. Catalina was quickly approaching the end of her life, and she didn't like me. When I took her on her walks, I applauded the healthy nature of her shit. I said things like, "Good poop, Catalina. Good, solid poop." And I collected the poop delicately in a light blue poop bag scented like baby powder that I pulled from a plastic poop bag dispenser in the shape of a bone in the mudroom before our walk. Usually, I made sure to bring 2 poop bags with me, and on these walks, Catalina only pooped once. But when I brought 1 poop bag, Catalina pooped twice. This was the nature of our relationship. Catalina was gravely ill. Her owners, my friend's parents, explained to me. They were traveling to Sweden for 2 weeks to my friend's father's birth city where, my friend said, toilets cannot be flushed during certain hours of the day and night because it would violate a strictly enforced noise code. They, my friend's parents, did not want Catalina to be alone, so their house was to be my house for 2 weeks, and my friend's bedroom was to be my bedroom. They were rich. They had a swimming pool and a kind of garden planned with elaborate carelessness that was messy with a thatch of thorny-looking plants with dark green pointed leaves. Catalina was beautiful, a cream-colored chow chow. Her eyes were little brown triangles. It was hard to believe she was sick. She had some kind of cancer. I came over to the house before my friend and his parents were to leave for Sweden. They wanted to show me certain important things regarding Catalina's special and fundamental diet. I liked my friend's parents, but they were slightly crazy. My friend's father gave me a quick tour of the house. This is a bathroom. That is a toilet, and that is a sink. This is a room, and this is another room. Door, window, hallway. Another window. Lots of windows in this place. Ha ha. Stairs, he said. He instructed me in great detail on how to operate the oven, microwave, and TV, and even handed me the TV remote so that I could try it out. My friend's mother led me outside to the garden. She said, "My garden is my heart." She pointed and let me know which plants should be watered and when. That one gets water every day. That one, once every other day. She stepped sedately down a flagged path, covered thickly in crust-like lichen, and continued on with her instructions. That plant in the corner never gets water. The one next to it gets water every 3 days or 4, but never every other or every day. Make sure you water that one over there after the sun has set, otherwise it will surely die. That one should be watered no more than once a week. Catalina's food was prepared with an assortment of different powders, exactly 3 drops of white milky liquid, chilled purified water, 2 different kinds of pills that had to be rolled in peanut butter, and love. This was quickly explained to me, the love part emphasized. Then my friend and his parents were off to Sweden. At first I thought Catalina liked me. She followed me everywhere I went. I mixed her special food uncertainly, afraid that she would die at any moment. She let me pet her between the ears and even licked my hand lavishly with her blue-black tongue. I thought I must have been doing something right. Catalina made sure to sleep in the same room as me. I listened to her dreaming, watched her paws gesture in quick pulses. I thought I liked her too. But as the first week drew to a close, we realized we were not so fond of each other. My friend told me that I could use his desktop computer. I looked under history and clicked on all the pornographic videos. I didn't like it when Catalina was in the room when I watched the videos my friend had watched. When I steered her into the hallway and closed the door, she barked and barked, a deep explosive bark that pummeled through the door, and it was hard to concentrate on the videos. I could see her chow chow nose trying to slip under the bottom of the door. After I came, I was light and hollow and clear-headed, and the day seemed to gain innumerable, dreadful hours. I opened the door. Catalina looked bored and angry, and I didn't care. She looked at my face, I thought, with eyes that were tired of looking at my face. I mixed her food and ordered pizza from Pizza Pronto. I tried the best I could to water the garden, my friend's mother's heart. But I was doing it all wrong. Her heart, a mesh of skulking fluoride, was slowly shriveling up and turning as rust brown as the scattering of needles that had shed from the neighbor's hulking pine tree. When I looked up at the tree, the first word that came to mind was corrupt. Catalina watched me gracelessly fish the needles from the swimming pool using the too long aluminum pool skimmer. She was criticizing me, I thought. I wanted to tell her that I could never look at a swimming pool the same way after I'd read a found copy of The Desperado while visiting my grandparents in Florida. But she was Catalina, the dog, and I only really talked to her about healthy, solid defecation. My grandparents lived in a gated residential community called Century Village. In order to live in Century Village, one had to be over the age of 70. And that is why most everyone who lived outside the gates of Century Village called it Cemetery Village. I found the Desperado in Cemetery Village's Bunko and Bingo rec room, and because Bingo would not be played for several more hours and I had exhaustively soaked my eyes in reality TV for a solid week, I immediately started to read it. It was about a man, a Lawrence Ho Hopkins, who was trying to design the perfect swimming pool. The perfect swimming pool, according to Lawrence Ho Hopkins, was a sacred form that could touch the underside of what sat just below the surface of the skin and engage the entire self when a person was immersed in living water with a naked body. It was a shame that more people didn't embrace the idea of swimming naked, Lawrence Ho Hopkins explained to his friend Jimmy while they were out fishing on Lake Okeechobee. The flesh, Jimmy, should be touched all over and simultaneously with the same urgency, Lawrence Ho Hopkins' character says as he scrapes the scales off a fat sunfish. Jimmy looks on, drinking a sweating beer. It is a beautiful book, really, with parts like an overexposed photograph. At its core, I think it's about man and nature, not man versus nature. I was naked and Catalina growled. Her lower teeth were missing, so I knew that if she lunged and bit me, it wouldn't hurt. I dove into the swimming pool. Catalina trotted around and around the pool's perimeter, as if at any moment she would jump in and overtake me. The water was surprisingly cold, and something strange and irrepressible worked its way down from the back of my head to my tailbone before cutting into the rest of my body. I moved in ways I never knew I could. I sank to the bottom despite frantically kicking my legs, and when I pushed back up with my feet and broke the water's surface, I sensed that the experience of my life had somehow widened. I pulled myself out of the pool and lay shivering on the patio stones, trying to catch my breath. Catalina sat down in front of me and probed my head hesitantly with her chow chow nose. It wasn't a seizure, but I knew instinctively that what I had just experienced in the water was a sign that something was wrong inside my body. My friend and his parents returned safely from Sweden on the 4th of July. Goodbye, I said to Catalina. Goodbye, I said to my friend's mother's neglected garden heart. Sometime in August, after I left a medical facility where I'd gotten some tests done, I spotted my friend eating breakfast in the middle of the afternoon. He had grown a beard that made his face look long and disagreeable. I was feeling lightheaded and scared because I'd had my blood drawn, and all I could do was wait. I wanted to spread myself out like a blanket on the earth, but instead I picked up the swab of taped cotton in the crook of my arm where the needle had bit. I ordered orange juice. Things were not altogether well. I knew that my friend's mother had been devastated with the state of her garden. It had held her body and soul together. I had never felt so capably poisonous. I finished my orange juice and my friend told me that Catalina had died. Then I went on a walk in the cemetery with a girl I liked. I bought the smallest, roundest watermelon I could find in a giant cardboard box filled with melons at the grocery store. "How will we eat it?" she asked when I arrived at the cemetery gates. I held the melon in my hands and looked at it. I raised it as high above my head as I could and let it drop to the ground. It gasped wetly when it split open into two perfect halves. I was enormously stupefied. It is possible that there are some people who are sorry for me, but I only let myself think about such things occasionally. 4. For my 26th birthday, my sister and my friend each sent me a different edition of the same book. The book is called The Dutiful Servant, and it is a book I should have liked in theory, but didn't. Later, I told my friend that I didn't like the book, but I will never tell my sister. The edition my friend sent me is small and thick, light green, aesthetically pleasing to the eye, and nice to carry in and out of cafes, the bedroom, bathrooms, etc. The edition my sister sent me is larger and dark blue with a busy cover that is easily marked. I have never opened it. On my 26th birthday, I taught composition at a community college in the Midwest, where I lived on a haunted farm whose address included two opposing cardinal directions. Propped up against a wall was a broom that toppled over at exactly 11 o'clock every night. No matter where I moved it, the broom slid to the floor and clattered at exactly 11 o'clock every night. And though I didn't really believe in ghosts, I made sure to pick up the broom every morning and prop it up against the wall. I didn't know too many people. I got day-long headaches. Red splotches appeared in the center of everything I looked at. The well water tasted like blood and colored my white t-shirts brown, stiffened cotton so that when I pulled on my socks, the threads cracked and formed small holes. Cold air constantly pricked my ankles. The sheep were dumb, and I liked them, and their lampant eyes reminded me of glowing keyholes. There was a young fox that stalked the hens, and on my 26th birthday, I spotted bloodied feathers scattered in the dried-up creek bed. I pictured a hen in the fox's maw, her snapped neck bent at an impossible angle, her beaded orange eyes shiny as buttons, and her slack red comb sweeping against the ground like a paintbrush. A young woman drove her car into a tree and died on my 26th birthday. "Formal papers with page numbers, please," I reminded my students on my 26th birthday. The Dutiful Servant is a quick read. It is about a monkey named Hieronymus and a bear named Benno and the servant that cares for them in a manor house. Sometimes I like to imagine the two editions of The Dutiful Servant I was sent on my 26th birthday as the two animals, the smaller edition as Hieronymus and the larger edition as Benno. Every now and then, my sister enters my thoughts, and when she does, she sits down, takes up space, and makes herself at home. In high school, she used to run away to New Jersey for weeks at a time, and I wondered what it would be like to have a sister who had been murdered in a motel in New Jersey. That's where I pictured her, and that's where she really was. The guidance counselor took me into his office one day during second period and asked if I was okay. His name was Mr. Sukunik, and he would be dead nearly a year later. Perhaps then, as he asked if I was okay in his office, his folded arms resting on an unmarked desk calendar, his thumb and forefinger working tediously around a pink eraser, the cancer deep in his esophagus reaching down into his stomach was only a slight discomfort, a light yet persistent cough. I told Mr. Sukunik that I was okay, but secretly wished I wasn't. I would only learn how to lie later. My sister always returned. She looked the same, only tired, and once with her belly button pierced, and once with small blue rhinestones embedded in her nails, and every time smelling of the car freshener, a velveteen yellow evergreen that spewed a scent called vanilla aroma. And she saw a psychiatrist twice a week. One night she emptied a bottle of aspirin into her mouth and crawled into my bedroom to say that she loved me and that she was going to die. I was studying for an AP US history exam. I turned around. She was curled up with one hand clutching her stomach, the other sadly pawing the green carpet. I told her that I heard in school that aspirin didn't kill you, only gave you painful, bloody ulcers for life, and that she had to throw up if she didn't want painful, bloody ulcers for life. She wept, I think, out of frustration into her long, loose shirt, a Grateful Dead t-shirt with a spiral of bears on a tie-dyed background. I heard her in the bathroom making desperate choking sounds, the pelleting of half-dissolved aspirin, the bright jostle of the tipped toilet lever, and the sound of rushing water. I could never have imagined then that she would mail me a book when I turned 26. Her edition was carefully wrapped in blue and white wrapping paper and tucked snugly inside a cardboard box. There was a small card attached, a message inside written in large, looping handwriting that ended with, "Love, your sister." It was handwriting that spoke of a happy, carefree life. When I was 26, I read The Dutiful Servant, taught composition, and even though I loved animals, I learned how to kill grouse from a man who had a wasted look and lived off the grid after his house had exploded from a natural gas leak. "Going off the grid is no game," he would tell me. Pink twisting birthmark on his neck that I thought looked perverse. He turned the birds upside down and set their heads through a narrow opening in a cone and gripped a knife and it ran it across the pouches in their necks. And we watched the hot blood spill out and spatter into a barrow filled with straw and send up sluggish curls of steam. The birds convulsed and became cold and perfectly still, and we scalded them in a drum of hot water and plucked their beautiful feathers out and tossed them into the waste bin. And the bird's meat and stew was chewy and gamey, and I felt sick and ashamed. "You choose the grid you want to get off of," I heard the man's voice boom inside my head. I saw the tree the young woman drove into, its impressive splay of branches, its magnificent trunk I imagined her body breaking so easily against, like an egg brought down on the lip of a nice glass bowl. When it was dark, the coyotes came out to play. I listened to their busted laughter. It keened wickedly like whirling firecrackers, and dread scooped into me. My body vibrated. The coyotes sounded so close, but I knew they were near the wind turbines across the field. I turned off all the lights and stood at the window and looked out, just like I had when my sister crawled into the bathroom the night she'd swallowed all the aspirin. I listened, but then there was nothing. I waited. Somewhere in the house, a ghost passed through the wall and saw what a mess I'd made. The broom handle smacked the ground. Thank you.